Okay, let me kick off. First of all, thank you very much for coming. Welcome to this online event held by the London School of Economics International Inequalities Institute. We're talking about a very topical issue today. My name's Neil Lee. I'm Professor of Economic Geography and an associate of the Institute. So today we're talking about the COVID shock, and we're talking about the COVID shock and the implications for inequalities and the future of work. We know that this is a highly topical issue. The COVID shock has changed everyone's lives. We are now familiar, or not quite as familiar as we probably should have been, with Zoom technology. The COVID shock's changed everyone's working lives in ways which would have been unimaginable simply a year ago. We would not have thought that we would be running events online or so on. So it's been an economic shock, it's been a social shock, and it's been a technology shock. And it's sped up the use of new technologies such as Zoom. But these changes have been highly uneven, and there are significant concerns that they've sped up processes of employment polarization, growth at the top and the bottom of the income scale, labor market fragmentation, and perhaps even increasing this, what we sometimes call the skills bias of the economy. And we've got three wonderful speakers to discuss these issues here today. First up, we have Yvette Cooper, MP for Normanton, Pontefract, and Castleford. Now, we're really delighted to welcome Yvette. We initially invited her for two reasons. The first is that she's built up a reputation as one of the most incisive and sort of intelligent politicians in the UK today. Hopefully that isn't damning you with faint praise, but it's a, we mean it in the best sense. But we're also particularly keen to have her because she was chair for of the Fabian Commission on Workers and Technology. It's published in December, makes a great contribution to this debate, and we're going to be posting a link so you can get through to it in the chat. And it turns out also that Yvette is LSE alumni, which is, of course, probably no coincidence. So we're delighted to welcome her back. Our second speaker is Avik Bhattacharya. Now, Avik is chief economist at the Social Market Foundation. He's a rising star of UK public policy, and also, not coincidentally, it turns out he's a graduate of our PhD program as well. Avik's the author of a recent edited collection on political philosophy in a pandemic, co-edited with Faye Naicker. And available via Bloomsbury Publishing. Now, actually, I first got to know Avik when he was my teaching assistant at the LSE. And one of the things which he used to do was there we would get difficult questions from students, and rather than answer them himself, he would pass them on to me to answer. And so now the tables have turned, Avik, and I look forward to sending any difficult questions your way. And finally, we're delighted to be joined by the International Inequalities Institute's resident expert on work and employment, Professor Kirsten Sinbrook. Kirsten's a British Academy Global Professor and a Distinguished Policy Fellow here at the LSE. She's going to take us global. She's an expert on employment and employment policy and has published published high impact research on Europe, but also Latin America. She runs the Quality of Employment Project at the LSE, and we're hugely excited to have her. So what's going to happen is each speaker is going to give a short presentation. Yvette, Avik, then Kirsten. Then there's going to be lots of time for questions, and the event should last about 8 p.m. GMT. Now, before I hand over to the speakers, I just need to give a plug for two more events we have coming up. Tomorrow, we have in our Migration, Ethnicity, and Race seminar series, we have a paper being presented on migrants in the Chilean labour market, a story of successful integration. And we have a really great speaker, Kirsten, is speaking then, 1 p.m. And next Tuesday, the 16th of February, we have the Changing Geography of Social Mobility in the United States at 12:30 p.m. as part of our International Inequalities Institute seminar series. And there's going to be a link in the chat function where we give you more sort of plugs and more information on online events. I just need to say that this event is also live on Facebook. So it's not just the people on Zoom. And also to encourage you to ask questions in the Q&A as we go on, although we'll take questions once all three speakers have presented. So, with no further ado, Yvette, thank you so much for coming back to the LSE to give us your views on this topic. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Neil. Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it today. I think, Neil, as you said, the fact we're having this debate on Zoom at all, the fact, I mean, a year ago when all of this started, I'd never used Zoom. Today, I spoke in Parliament, asking a Zoom question of the Home Secretary from Parliament to the Hanforth Parish Council. Democracy has been running and keeping going on Zoom, but so many jobs have kept going through new technology as a result of the crisis. Online ordering, remote distance working, manufacturers changing production methods to ensure social distancing during the COVID crisis or to cope with fewer staff when demand is low or when people get sick or are self-isolating or looking after children at home. So there is no doubt that technology has changed and has saved jobs during the COVID crisis. It's also changed jobs and changed the way many of us work. But it is also accelerating the automation that is replacing so many jobs, particularly among low-skilled workers. And just look at the news today with Boohoo buying up the Dorothy Perkins and Burton brands, but 214 shops will close and 2,400 staff will lose their jobs. And this isn't just in the midst of the crisis, it's also about where we go from here. Because one major Yorkshire company that I've talked to that's consulting staff on what happens once COVID restrictions are lifted, they're talking now about moving to 2 to 3 days a week in the office, 2 to 3 days a week working from home. And that's a reflection of what staff have said they want to avoid the daily commute, to improve the quality of their jobs. But the consequences, of course, will be downsizing of office accommodation with an impact on office cleaning jobs or sandwiches or support services that have supported those office jobs for many years. The pubs and restaurants that once they get to reopen, if they can manage to operate with fewer staff, are likely to do so using things like remote ordering and other ways of reducing staff at a time when they've still got to recover, having been through such difficult and pressured times. And the automation that might otherwise have taken many years has been put on steroids by businesses looking at different ways to respond to the shock, to the crisis that we're all still going through. So these are the things that the Commission on Workers and Technology has been looking at. We were set up by the Changing Work Centre, the Fabians and Community Trade Union coming together to look at technology's change from the point of view, from a worker's eye point of view. When we started this, though, we thought we were looking at a sort of incremental process of change and how you address inequalities that might widen, how you might address and make sure that there is enough support for workers as those changes take place. Of course, all of that has been put on steroids by the COVID crisis. And now we're seeing, I think, the real urgent need for action, including government action, employer action, trade union action, community action in order to address what otherwise might become very serious and deep widening inequalities as a result of this combination of the COVID crisis and accelerating automation. So we looked at it and described this as a COVID double whammy hitting particularly low paid and low qualified workers. We looked, for example, at the workers who are most likely to be furloughed during the course of this year in the sectors that have been most heavily hit by the COVID crisis, and found that 61% of those of the furloughed jobs were also in the sectors that were at highest risk of automation replacing jobs in future, particularly hospitality, but also high street retail, other sectors like that as well. So a serious risk that in those sectors, even once the economy starts to grow again, the jobs that have been furloughed just don't come back again, and that people lose their opportunities for jobs in the future. We found particularly those who are the youngest and oldest in the labour market, most likely to be heavily hit. Those youngest workers always have been very often most heavily hit by recessions, those who are looking for new jobs. But this is particularly acute in this crisis because hospitality is the sector most heavily affected, and it's often the area where young people can get their first job before starting out in their careers. We've seen too widening inequalities and pressures, particularly on women in the labour market, particularly those trying to also look after children at home and not getting support from their employers. and for Black and minority ethnic workers, more likely to be either in exposed key worker jobs or to have been furloughed or to have been made redundant in the crisis. And so that risk of widening inequality, that for some technology improves the jobs and the quality of jobs for those staff working in that Yorkshire company that I referred to, who may potentially get more choice over the way and how they work. But for those who are low qualified or lowest paid, getting less choice and getting less opportunities and seeing fewer jobs available in the future. And that is the challenge, is how you make sure that with a new wave of technology, the benefits, the productivity gains, the prosperity that new technology can create can be fairly shared by all, as opposed to seeing that technology acceleration when combined with the COVID crisis end up widening inequalities and widening injustice. We looked at some of the possible policy responses, some of the things that we called on government to do. Some of it is things that we want to see urgent action in the short term. For example, going much further than the Kickstarter scheme, which is still far too small and far too limited support for young workers who are made unemployed. Instead, we should be looking at work and train guarantees so that everyone who might face long-term unemployment is guaranteed a work or training. It should include direct funding of additional jobs in care or in tackling climate change. We argued for a huge expansion of training and adult education. We should be offering urgent training and education for furloughed workers. What a missed opportunity for people who are currently furloughed and unable to work to not be able to get access to the training or education opportunities in case their job does not come back again and they may need to change jobs or careers or find work in new sectors. We've argued too, going forward, for much more support for industrial strategies that support particularly those areas of the economy that have got high levels of employment, but also may face the most rapid change. Working through social partnerships, strategies involving government, employers and trade unions to draw up plans, both to support the productivity increases we need and the take up of technology, but also to support the workforce, maybe to upgrade skills to get work with technology within those sectors, maybe to get jobs in new sectors as well. And we looked at how you give workers a stronger voice in this. And just as a quick example, we visited an Asda distribution warehouse where the employer had been working closely with the GMB trade union on the adoption of new technology that everyone supported. It had made the workers' lives better, improved health and safety, improved productivity, and they got a pay rise as a result. But then we also heard from people who worked in the Amazon warehouse about the way in which technology had been used to more closely monitor workers to make their jobs feel more difficult, and where unionisation had been resisted and where there were real concerns about both the quality and pay of people involved as well. We argued too for the longer term about more support for training, for education, things like expanding the Union Learning Fund rather than abolishing it, but also expanding adult education in different ways and supporting statutory training leave and training pay to make it possible for people to afford to train. And then also looking, this is not just about skills and qualifications and helping people adapt. It's also about valuing some of the key worker jobs, some of the jobs which involve currently low qualifications but are still vital to our communities and our economy, such as care work, some of the caring jobs that are likely to expand even as technology changes, but currently are still low paid and undervalued in the economy that we have. And we also then argued for, look, there is a big picture here, which is change is going to continue to accelerate. We've seen that as we come through the COVID crisis, but also as we move forward as well. In previous waves of huge industrial and technological change, it has taken generations for the benefits of those changes to be spread fairly across communities and across generations and across people with different backgrounds and skills. And it's often taken the creation of new institutions like the welfare state, the trade union movement, and so on to be able to respond and make sure that injustices and exploitation are challenged and tackled. We can't wait generations for these things to happen. We have to make sure that as we see new technology be taken up across the economy, that we have the support in place to make sure that everyone benefits and that no one is left behind. Thank you very much.
Wonderful stuff. Thank you very much. I'll hand over now to Avik.
So I think if we think about the economic impact of COVID-19, there's basically two types of impact we need to take into consideration. There's a kind of immediate temporary shock, but many of the shocks that we've endured kind of over the last few months will leave kind of a lasting legacy. So there's been a slight increase in unemployment and potentially an expected kind of higher increase still over the months and maybe the year or so to come, with unemployment forecast to peak kind of over 2.5 million. There's the debt that the government has taken on with a dramatic increase in the public debt to GDP ratio in order to pay for a lot of the furlough scheme and the various supports that the government has rightly put in place. But actually, more concerningly for me, is the amount of debt the businesses have taken on. And according to one estimate, about 900,000 businesses, 1 in 7 of all firms, are at risk of closure over coming months as a result of indebtedness. The effect on kind of household finances has been very different from some households to the other. So in aggregate, household savings have increased, which is kind of unsurprising given that people don't have to spend on commuting and can't spend on a lot of the shopping and going out that they otherwise would. But at certain ends of the market, certain ends of the job market, particularly kind of lower paid workers, those that have been laid off or furloughed, obviously their finances have deteriorated, with about 2 million people estimated as moving into low financial resilience. And as I suspect we're all aware of the educational impact, given the closure or the physical closure of schools, colleges, universities, that is bound to have an impact. And it's been estimated there's been about 2 months worth of learning loss in schools, just as an illustration. But as well as that kind of immediate effect, there are many of the changes that Yvette was discussing just a second ago, these structural changes to the way that the economy works. So remote working, with around half of the workers in the economy having done some work at home, and the vast majority of them wanting to continue to do at least a few days out of the office as we move forward. There's been the shift to online. Internet sales before the crisis were less than 20% of all retail. Now they're over a third. That's likely to endure. It's unclear what the kind of outlook is for hospitality and leisure. You might have thought that given that Zoom pub quizzes might take the place of the real thing, I'm more skeptical on that. I expect that actually, there's going to be quite a lot of pent-up demand for people wanting to go out and see each other physically in the months to come. But there's at least a question mark there. An under-noticed phenomenon, but I think potentially quite a significant one, is the consolidation of many sectors of the economy. You might call this the Amazon effect. You can see Amazon kind of potentially cutting through swathes of the high street. And that figure I gave of 1 in 7 firms being potentially in financial trouble, well, 15% of firms with less than 10%, with fewer than 10 employees, are at risk of failure. It's only 4% for those with over 100. We're going to see potentially bigger firms sweeping up kind of large sections of certain sectors of the economy. And on automation, Yvette gave quite a few examples. I think that has been a trend over the past few months. It will be interesting to see how far that continues, because insofar as we get higher unemployment, that might be a pressure in the other direction. We certainly saw after the financial crisis, the availability of quite a lot of cheap labor, I think probably held back automation. But I think maybe this time round with a higher minimum wage, that effect might be weaker. But I don't think the automation picture is as clear cut as you might think. Now, if we put all this together, I would say it's quite a pessimistic outlook. I'd say almost all of these developments are bad news for economic equality. The immediate economic hits, as Yvette was saying, has been worst in low-paying sectors like retail and hospitality, and those sectors potentially face the greatest upheaval in the months to come. If we're talking about home working as this big kind of employment trend, well, the people who are going to benefit at least initially are going to be the affluent white collar workers. It's the better off who are more likely to be allowed to work from home. And that's the kind of initial effect there. This consolidation, the large firms, the superstar firms, the Amazons, it's likely to, again, that's likely to exacerbate inequality. What we know about these firms is generally they pay out less of their income to workers and wages, and they give out more to owners and shareholders who tend to be better off. Again, that's going to tend to drive up inequality. That disparate effect on household finances, it's unsurprising that that has been regressive. So it's richer households who've been able to save more. And it's the bottom 20% who are actually saving less and who are more likely to be in financial difficulties. Completely unsurprising, but again, that's another kind of drag on inequality. And the educational deficit that we've seen, as we know, it hasn't been equally shared. The attainment gap has widened for the first time in a number of years. And over the coming years without kind of any remedy, that is going to exacerbate inequality further. When I sat down and thought about it, the only possible silver lining I could see is there might be some kind of benefit from a bit of spreading out, from a regional rebalancing, and potentially from some correction of the housing market. So if you look at people in poverty in London, they're spending over 50% of their income on housing, where it's under a third in other parts of the country. If we can move some of those low-paid workers, if they can get jobs outside of the capital, for example, outside of the more expensive cities, that could be at least some kind of boon to the least well-off. And you can start to tell a story about how the structural changes we're seeing, the home working revolution, could reduce regional inequality. If it's pushing people out of the expensive centres, the kind of the parts of the country that have been doing well, to kind of poorer parts of the country and cheaper parts of the country, that could be beneficial in lots of ways, not least in the housing market. And as I said, just because it's the white collar workers who are remote working in the first instance, that could have spillover effects. So as Yvette was saying, there might be fewer jobs, office cleaning and for the sandwich shops in the areas around office blocks, but potentially you could imagine people moving out to cheaper areas out of the kind of metropolises and spending locally in their high streets and their cafes, in their restaurants, and creating jobs and potentially moving people out as well. But based on current patterns, that's I'm skeptical that's going to be the case. It's going to need people to move out further than they are at the moment. So this is a piece of analysis I saw just this week, which was looking at if based on current commuting patterns, if you redistribute the economic activity, and here the darker blue shading is an increase in employment, the darker red shading is a decrease in employment. And if you look here, this is not money going, this is not kind of economic activity flowing to what we might call left behind areas. Yes, London is losing, but London is losing and Hampshire and Kent and Buckinghamshire are gaining. I'm not sure that that's kind of the regional rebalancing. I'm not sure that that's going to cause, that's not going to bring the benefits that we might have hoped for. There's also kind of obviously the gender angle. I think this is a little bit more ambiguous. So there was probably a bit of a bifurcation of the of female employment in the last few months. There's areas, so women were more likely to be key workers working in essential kind of services like healthcare, social care, education, but also more likely to be employed in retail and hospitality, where as we've been discussing, the challenges are greatest. And as we see kind of potential kind of strain in the labour market, potentially women might be less attached, and so we might be worried about them becoming detached from the labour force. But equally, we could see shifting gender norms, both in terms of employers being more likely to offer remote working and women potentially benefiting from that, and possibly, as Yvette was saying, maybe a bit more valuation of care work within the home, a bit more appreciation and a bit of a more even division of labour. So it could go both ways, but again, I'm a little bit I would be concerned for my starting position. I'd like to say a little something about the global impact. I think these debates can often be quite domestic focused, UK focused. And if we were sitting here a year ago talking about the big shock that was going to hit the world, I think probably the first time in decades that there's been a shock that has affected every economy almost in the world, I would be very concerned about what that does for the poorest countries in the world, for the poorest people in the world. And actually, sitting here in February 2021, poor countries have fared much better than I would have expected, and in fact, in many cases, fared better than the richest countries. The data on overall global inequality is quite interesting because actually global inequality has increased somewhat, but that's been driven by China, which is now a middle-income country and skews all the statistics just because it has such so many people and such a great share of the global population. Because that grew fast, because China grew faster than poorer countries, that has ticked global inequality up a little bit, but by far less than we might have feared. That said, the coming months and years bring massive challenges and global inequality could get worse still. So we're seeing vaccine rollout very slowly, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. We're seeing a burgeoning debt crisis, which could limit poorer countries' ability to support their citizens through the kind of choppy economic waters ahead. But on the other hand, there may be opportunities for low and middle income countries. And some of these may be threats to the British economy as well. So there's an interesting dynamic there. So there's some fear with remote working that could lead to offshoring of white collar work, but that potentially could bring better paid jobs to poorer countries and support their economies there. Certainly with middle income countries, I think we're seeing some of this dynamic in relation to Eastern Europe. A lot of the highly educated workers who would go to richer countries might opt to stay where they are. And again, you might get what's called the brain gain there, the opposite of the brain drain that we've seen in recent decades. So the global picture, I think, will be interesting as well. So having set out quite a pessimistic picture, having said that there's a lot of reasons to be concerned, I think this basically lays down the gauntlet and it is a real challenge for policymakers to avoid inequality running rampant in the years to come. And I think it's interesting because many of the social economic changes that we've seen through the pandemic have been changes that were in the post anyway, but they've just been brought forward or put on steroids, as Yvette put it. And I think the policy response, there's kind of a mirror there because the things that policymakers should do are things I think they should have been doing anyway, but they're all the more urgent because the challenges we're facing now. And there's a lot of overlap between my laundry list here and Yvette's as well. So progressive taxes are important, but they're all the more important when you've had this massive shock and the richer households gaining and poorer households losing out. And I think this probably strengthens the case for a wealth tax, which has been discussed for a while, but I think might make particular sense in the current context. Active policies support employment, all the more important, and potentially there might be a case for a job guarantee, the state acting as an employer of last resort. Investment in skills and education, any economist will tell you that that's kind of the lifeblood of an economy. But yet there has been neglect of adult education in the UK. Adult education funding has fallen by about 1.3 billion in real terms in the last decade. That gap has to be filled in at the very least, and ideally more. If you want regional rebalancing, it can't really happen without investment in transport and telecoms infrastructure. The government has, there are bold and ambitious targets for the spread of high-speed broadband, but we're quite far behind. And that's going to be an integral part of the rebuilding thing. And for all the challenges that the UK faces, it can't forget the rest of the world. So support for low and middle income countries, debt forgiveness, vaccinations, all of these things are going to be critical in the years to come. And at a time when the UK government is rolling back on its aid commitments, I think the global picture that we're seeing, the global challenges that we're seeing, lay those priorities to question. Thanks.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Avik. Now we'll move on to Kirsten. Thank you.
I'm going to try and move this conversation a little bit more into sort of the realm of the future and away from the immediate detail of the COVID crisis. And I'm going to focus on a couple of issues. The first is, I agree with all the assessment that's been presented so far by Yvette and Avik about the problems that the COVID crisis is revealing in the labour market. But I would hope that it also creates a political opportunity for addressing some of these issues. And I also agree with what the speaker said about the fact that really this COVID crisis is not revealing anything that we didn't know before about the problems that we face in our labour market. These problems have always been there. They've been there for a very long time, at least. And the COVID crisis has, on the one hand, revealed them, but on the other hand, accelerated them. And if there are two points that I would like you to take away from this presentation, it's the idea that we have been, for quite a long time, directly and indirectly subsidising precarious employment in different ways, including its negative externalities. And we haven't really been holding companies accountable for how they are employing people. So I'm going to look at those general issues and just to say that by precarious employment, I mean the various forms of short-term and temporary contracts that we have, variable hours contracts, including zero-hour contracts, employing self-employed people as independent contractors rather than as employees, and so on. So the only other thing that I would like to add to what the previous speaker said about the inequalities resulting from this crisis is that the initial studies have also revealed that on the one hand, we have these income inequalities and educational inequalities and so on that we normally think about, but there also is a very significant divide between those people who have precarious jobs and those people who have good jobs. And the ones who are more likely to survive in this labour market are the ones who have the good, stable, permanent jobs, more highly skilled, etc. And this picture has already become very much obvious in the initial studies that have been undertaken. The liberal market economies, such as the US and the UK, which have more of these flexible jobs, are losing much more employment at a quicker rate than, for example, the traditional corporatist models, such as Germany, for example, in Europe. And among the workers with precarious contracts, those are the worst hit, and also those who are not in the sort of non-salaried sector, so self-employed, but also independent contractors who should be really working as wage earners, as salaried workers. But again, I would like to emphasize that none of these are new problems. It's really just that the COVID crisis is revealing them. And the other thing, of course, that we have to bear in mind is not only has the COVID crisis, or will it change the way we work, and some of the job losses that we are seeing now may indeed be permanent, but we also have to factor in what we know about the future of employment and the future of work, which again is a very hot topic in recent years, as people expect many job losses as a result of the advances of artificial intelligence and technology. So we kind of have to add this into the equation. And I think if there's one thing that this COVID crisis really has illustrated, it's how fast we can adapt to a new technology once it becomes available and once it's proven that it works, such as, for example, these Zoom calls. Now, at the moment, we're much better at forecasting these job losses, the tasks that will be automated, than we are at estimating what the new generation of jobs will bring and how many new jobs will be created. But it's very clear that the labour market will be impacted overall. There's not just going to be a hollowing out of the labour market, but it's also clear that the more skilled and the more educated will have better opportunities for adjusting to the changes that are coming. Now, the problem that we have is that we already have many jobs in the labour market that are quite precarious. We've had this situation at the moment under full employment. The question is, what is this going to look like when employment rates increase and when technology and AI start replacing jobs? So I think we have a potential there for a compounding situation, which can really mean that in the long run, our current welfare systems and the way they are set up could become unsustainable. Now, I want to come back to this point about government subsidies. Now, we know the easy example to cite is a company like Uber, where we know they don't pay VAT on their services, the drivers don't pay social insurance contributions, or if they do, they pay probably less than they normally would. The same goes for income tax. And yet the state has to step in when there's a requirement for welfare benefits, for healthcare, and for other subsidies. And the state also has to step in when there are negative externalities, such as health risks or climate effects from people, from cars circulating, or the potential social and political instability that we've already seen in many countries, where protests suddenly take over and destabilize the economy. Now, the Uber scenario is a very clear-cut case where all of these factors come together. But what studies also show is that people with other forms of precarious contracts, for example, zero-hour contracts, end up contributing less, and as a government, we end up having to pay more. So at the moment, this model is sustained because we have a very large proportion of the labour force which is still working under normal conditions with permanent stable jobs, etc. But as we lose jobs, as future technology takes over and replaces workers, and as potentially the COVID crisis has a longer term impact, this situation again creates a degree of unsustainability. Now, on the other hand, we have companies who are reporting some data on remuneration and employees, at least in the UK, but not in a very coherent or regulated format, and not in a format that's useful to governments who are trying to deal with this situation. And really, what I'm trying to say is that we are not really holding companies accountable for the way they employ employees. Now, these are some tables from the annual report of a FTSE 100 company. And apart from the very obvious inequalities that we can see, where the CEO's remuneration is equivalent to the total remuneration of the rest of the workers in the company, this is also a company that's well known for using zero-hour contracts. And again, these are the contracts where people very often have breaks in between contributing to social security systems or have very stressful working conditions as they juggle multiple jobs, etc. And there's nothing about that in the entire annual report. So a good place to start would be to, first of all, send a very strong signal that we expect companies to provide information on how they are hiring workers, because it does matter how workers are hired and what kind of jobs we are generating. At the global level, this kind of flexibility in developed countries, in the labour markets of developed countries, is kind of creating a convergence effect, because other developments such as AI and technology are improving labour markets and generating opportunities in some developing countries. But this is not something that we normally think about. So, for example, if Italy has an informal economy of 30%, that doesn't look that different from Chile, which is still not a developing country officially anymore, but certainly is not a developed country, where also informal workers are about 30% of the labour market. So this convergence is something that I think we need to keep an eye on, and that I think we need to measure. Now, if you look at the evidence on labour markets in developing countries, especially with regard to the impact of future technologies and AI, they are definitely creating new opportunities, but they are also creating new risks. So one of the big risks is that they will accelerate premature deindustrialization. For example, a factory in Bangladesh or in Vietnam, where the main asset is cheap labour. Well, if you replace that cheap labour with machines, because that can now be done, then really you are hitting poor countries where it hurts the most. These processes can also lead to a kind of reshoring. So we've spent many decades offshoring production to developing countries. New technology could mean that these jobs are then reshored to developed countries where companies can respond more quickly to markets and client preferences. But again, of course, this will lead to job losses in developing countries who can least afford it. And then, of course, there are the platform companies or platform economies, which are really sort of the Wild West of the labour market, especially in the international context. They are generating a race to the bottom by offering services or micro tasks. I'm talking about companies like Amazon, Mechanical Turk, or Upload, Dr.com, etc., where people can compete with their labour for a particular task and therefore offer as low a wage as possible for a task and are basically bidding for jobs, or where people have a relatively high rating because all these workers are very closely monitored and followed, and then rated according to their performance and capabilities. And where you have workers who have a high rating subcontracting their micro tasks to other workers who don't have that rating, but of course take a very significant cut of what is already a very low pay. And never mind discriminatory practices in these kind of economies. So you will often find sentences like Southeast Asian workers need not apply. There is no regulation of this whatsoever, and we are barely aware of what's going on in these economies. So I think not only are these developments that we need to keep an eye on, because of course we are a globalized world. If developing countries become destabilized politically as a result of social change and changes in the labor market, that will affect us and impact us all. But also there's a very, very big theoretical conceptual challenge here, which is the fact that we tend to think of labor markets as a national entity. We think of, you know, demand and supply, unemployment rates, wages, etc., but all within a national context. Now these new companies, they break that apart. These are no longer national labour markets, these are international labour markets. And international labour markets where we have very little capacity to monitor and measure what's going on. So these are all changes that we need to bear in mind going forwards, and that are likely to be compounded by the COVID crisis or changed by the COVID crisis in some shape or form. Now, in terms of addressing this with policies, both at the national and at the international level, I'll talk about the national level first. I think the first thing that we need just need to start doing is to measure job quality and come to a consensus, establish a commission about what it means to have a good quality job, what it means to have a bad quality job, define this, measure it, and publish it along with our unemployment rates. That's a very simple first step, so that the quality of the jobs that we have in the labour market becomes a topic that is as present in our minds as wages or the unemployment rate. The other key thing, I think, is to redirect the funds that we are using to subsidise the precarious and bad jobs in our labour market towards more productive forms of active labour market policies. In particular, anything that involves skills and retraining workers, even if this means replacing salaries for them temporarily. It means sharing out work between various different, between more workers. So that could be a concept of, like employment dosage, which researchers in Cambridge are currently working on, job sharing mechanisms, or short time work as they do in continental Europe, which, you know, I know we started in the UK doing that recently. But these kind of active labour market policies need to be strengthened and institutionalised. On the other hand, I think companies need to be much, much more accountable for their labour practices. And we shouldn't just rely on court cases to sort these issues out. So there clearly is a role here for governments to regulate. And I think that increasingly we are really facing ethical issues here. We treat workers in the labour market so differently, so unequally, depending on the type of contract that they have or depending on the type of employment regulation that they are subject to, that we really need to think about whether this is still ethical, the way we are treating them. And then, of course, we need to take account of the negative externalities of poor job quality. So the health consequences, the stress. We know that stress in employment leads to very significant health consequences. There can be potential future social costs, potential political costs. We've already seen a lot of that. Populism, social unrest, protests. I lived in Chile for 10 years until very recently and saw Chile literally fall apart in the space of 1 year as a result of the social and political protests because of the inequalities that were being generated, amongst other things, by the labour market. So these are, I think, key points that we can address at the national level. Again, I want to emphasise this idea that we're subsidising poor quality of employment. What we're really doing at the moment amounts essentially to subsidising the coal industry in a time of climate crisis. So just to emphasise that point, and also, again, on the other hand, to make companies accountable. In terms of the international global scenario, it just so happens that the institution that most deals with labour market issues is one of the most complex international institutions that we have, and one that has great difficulty in pushing this issue forward. So we certainly need to strengthen international institutions in terms of how they view employment and labour markets. And we also need to introduce specific measures, not just debate them, but actually agree on measures of how we can measure progress towards the Sustainable Development Goals. And there have been some ideas that have been put forward towards ethical codes of conduct, especially for platform economies, so that, again, these companies are held accountable for their employment practices. We do that much more at the moment when we have concrete specific supply chains than we do in the sort of in the cloud industries. At the same time, we also need to consider the impact of climate change. I think this is a big missing link in this entire debate. So we've got COVID, we've got the future of employment and technology and AI, but climate change will also change the way our labour markets function, what kind of jobs we have, and it will significantly contribute to political risk. Now, of course, the UK as a liberal market economy is actually in an ideal and unique position, perhaps less so since Brexit, but the UK is in a good position to push for these issues. So I'd like to conclude with that point. We have a labour market that we can use as an example for some of these issues, and we have a political position where we can push for some progress on these issues. Thank you.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much, all three of you. Great presentations. I'm going to kick off. So I would like to encourage the audience to type in your questions, but I have one which I'm going to sort of start off with as they're coming in. And that question's about age, because no one really mentioned that very much. And it strikes me that one of the things we've seen in the labour market is, one of the things we've seen in the sort of COVID shock is that age has become more important to people's sort of, you know, face-to-face contact and so on. But also I would regard, and you know, I don't know if this is just me, but my kids are much better at technology than I am. And I would imagine that that's a sort of general trait that the older you get, the sort of less adaptable you get. So I'm just wondering, I mean, do you have reflections on whether age has mattered in the sort of labour market impact of COVID and what the sort of responses might be? I will go, Yvette, you look keen. If we go Yvette, Avik, and then Kirsten, is that okay?
So I think the most immediate issue has been about the young workers, sort of new entrants to the labour market, particularly because of the way the hospitality sector has been hit, and the hospitality sector will often tend to have a younger workforce. But in terms of the impact on people who then struggle to get new jobs and struggle to get the next job, if your job goes, you are at much greater risk if you're an older worker. And that is about attitudes in the labour market, can be about opportunities in terms of retraining and most recent experience of using technology and using the kinds of things that can help you get new work. So that's why I think the government was right to do the Kickstart program. And it was very much modelled on the Future Jobs Fund, which I did as Work and Pension Secretary in the financial crisis. And that is a good thing, but it's much too limited. And our intention had been to expand it to cover all of the long term unemployed and to effectively, particularly to focus, to be able to focus on older workers as well, and, you know, over 50s in the labour market and so on, who may be particularly at risk of ending up in long term unemployment or inactivity, a sort of enforced early retirement, even if people don't actually have the savings to be able to cope with that. And to focus there as well. So I think in terms of immediate job losses, young people may be the most affected. But in terms of those long-term unemployment risks, there has to be much more support for older workers as well.
I mean, I have to say that I took the Future Jobs Fund off my syllabus last year because for my labour market course, because I thought, this is probably irrelevant now. And now suddenly it's back in the sort of public discourse. Sorry, Avik.
Agree with everything that Yvette just said. On top of that, I think there's this broader question of intergenerational equity that's been kind of bubbling under the surface for a number of years, and I think has been thrown into sharp relief by just what's happened in the last year, where younger people have kind of borne the economic brunt, have borne an educational brunt, and in general have been less well placed to kind of shoulder the social burdens. If you just compare the sort of housing that an average 23, 24 year old is in compared to the sort of housing that an average 50, 60 year old is in, and what that has meant in terms of the kind of costs of lockdown, I think that kind of brings into relief a broader kind of a more general story, which is that people who are in their 20s, maybe early 30s now, have been have faced kind of a much tougher kind of economic lot, and there's a lot of concerns. There's the general conversation about whether this will be the first generation to earn less than their parents, a generation that's been kind of shut out of the housing market in important ways. And I think we can have a very narrow conversation about the balance there and whether that's fair in terms of the immediate pandemic response. But like all these things, it's exacerbating a problem that was already there. And I think that hopefully that puts it on the agenda, that hopefully that makes us think about issues around housing, issues around wealth inequality, and the responses to that, as I kind of hinted at in my presentation, in a broader sense, rather than just beyond kind of thinking about COVID in an hour.
Thank you, Avik. Kirsten, sure.
Yes, I think the age issues are pretty much universal. Every labour market around the world will have problems with its younger workers and its older workers. I'd like to add one thing to the discussion, which is that younger workers will often perhaps be able to insert themselves, certainly after a time, into the labour market. But what we've seen in countries which have experienced high unemployment or which have experienced an economic crisis, such as this one, these younger workers then start in relatively precarious employment, in poor quality jobs, and then they find themselves stuck in these jobs. And so you find them rotating from one poor quality job to the next one, and it becomes very difficult to move out of that, even with several years of experience in the labour market. Also, in the case of young workers, they could also potentially join these platform economies and platform companies because they have the technological skill probably to participate in that market, which older workers won't have. But again, at the moment, we have about 8 million platform workers in the world, and we only have about half the world connected to the internet. The number of workers participating in this economy is increasing on a daily basis. And so, of course, the more people join these platform economies, the more the employment conditions deteriorate. So there's a potential here for a vicious circle, not just in the immediate future of, you know, unemployment among young people or older people, but also it could change labour market trends going forwards as well.
Wonderful. Thank you. So we've got a load of questions come in. I'm going to sort of try and group them a little bit and sort of hand them out as they were. And I'm going to sort of start off with a couple about skills and education. So Miguel Vidal-Bover, who's one of my students, so be good when you're giving your responses. He talks about investment in skills and education being key, but what the role of how the state intervenes in skill formation. So what types of skill or training should government aim to promote? And he's also a little bit interested in sort of regional inequalities here. So should we be focused on sort of local skills or skills which are more sort of transferable to other places? So that's the first one. The second is related to this is we have Shari McDade says, Michael Sandel argues that education cannot be relied upon to reduce inequalities other than retraining and getting young people into education. What policy solutions do you propose to ensure everyone can get a valued job? So sort of related questions. And if we go, who wants to kick off? Yvette, would you?
So those was which skills and also what more do you do on inequality?
Yeah, and what, yes. I guess maybe are we putting too much emphasis on skills would be the sort of counter view there.
So there's you know the film Primary Colours, which has in it there's a scene which is modelled on a 1992 speech by Bill Clinton during the election campaign. And it has John Travolta speaking in, I think it's a closed steel factory to a lot of steel workers, and in which he says, and it's supposedly a pivotal moment in the campaign, and it's based on a sort of key moment in the Clinton campaign, I can't promise you I will bring back your jobs, but I can promise you I will help you get your next job, and I will invest in the education, the skills, and so on, in the new jobs. Now, that is clearly extremely important and was, you know, in terms of helping people get the skills and for the new jobs, the future. But if you look at those places across America and across the UK as well, where Promises were made about education, training and skills. Actually, it wasn't enough to bring the new jobs into those areas that had suffered the greatest industrial decline. It wasn't enough because actually a lot of people who did get education then moved out and moved away to areas where new jobs were being created. And so if you want to tackle regional inequalities, yes, education and training is vital. And for many of our northern towns, actually, we do have lower levels of adult education, lower levels of skills, and we've seen those levels cut as well in the last few years, the number of people who are in adult education and training. So it is vital part of it, but you need more than education, training and skills. You also need investment in different areas. You need support for industries and a kind of vision and plan for those industries. And I think, and it goes back to the point I suppose I made earlier, right, we also have to start valuing a lot of the jobs that are often undervalued and underpaid within our economy that may not require the highest levels of qualifications, but do require different kinds of skills. For example, most particularly care work, which is immensely undervalued and is also an area of the economy where we would expect jobs to grow as we have an aging population as well. So yes, let's support education, training, skills, but let's also go much further in terms of raising the pay and the opportunities and the support for jobs that are still going to be for low qualified jobs and also for communities that need investment in them. And then in terms of the which skills and in terms of the way in which skills should be supported, I think that there has to be the ability for different areas and different local economies to also have the flexibility to provide additional training and support in areas that are going to be particularly key in those local labour markets as well. So we argued for sort of a national free education offer, free adult education offer for people, but also the ability for mayors or for local councils or local economic partnerships to be able to go further on making decisions about the local skills that are needed as well.
Fantastic, thank you. Avik, should we?
The which skills question is a really tough question and a really good one, I think. I mean, look, the reason we have a bajillion different books and reports written about the future of work and they don't all agree is because we don't know. No one has the blueprint and no one has the crystal ball that's going to tell you exactly what jobs there's going to be in 15 or 20 years. But we can make out some outlines. We can have some pretty good educated guesses. It seems very, very likely. I'd be pretty confident that there are jobs, going to be a fair number of green jobs in terms of getting to carbon zero. We can predict where that's going to be an area where there's going to be a lot of employment. We can predict with a fair amount of confidence there's going to be need for more workers in care, for example. That seems pretty straightforward. As Yvette was saying, I think we probably need to be doing it at a local level because it's going to vary from place to place. And so it's about having the institutions and infrastructure in order to be flexible and allow local institutions to respond to what the needs are in their area. And I guess also being flexible over time. So some of the skills, sometimes the skills might be more generic, not industry or firm specific. So particularly at kind of university level, we can see a lot of the degrees that maybe probably some of the people in the audience are doing are not kitting them out for a specific job, but giving them skills that hopefully they can repurpose as they go on. And we can also see where there are shortages in the economy right now. There are clear kind of shortages in higher technical skills. So a lot of educated guessing, and also I think flexibility in allowing people potentially to retrain instead of thinking this as a one-shot thing of you go back, you retrain, that's you fixed for the next 20 or 30 years. Let's see retraining as a lifelong thing, or see training as a lifelong skill development process, and potentially something that someone might have to come back to three or four times over the course of their career. On the point of education doesn't fix inequality, no it doesn't. And in my policy proposals, there were a few that are not reliant on education. So I think there isn't going to be a substitute for progressive taxation and social spending for in terms of addressing inequality. I think also, as I mentioned, that the idea of a jobs guarantee, part of what that does is it has the state, I think this maybe relates to Kirsten's point as well, in that you can have the state as strengthening workers' hands in the sense of, if you have the potential of a job offer from the state, if you know that there is that backstop, then you don't have to go into the labour market and take anything and everything. And that potentially could have benefits that flow through in terms of addressing inequality. So those are just a couple of ideas, but yeah, if we should do a whole other seminar on how to address inequality, and I think we still wouldn't solve it.
We will. Kirsten.
I think the idea of lifelong learning that we've been talking about for the last few governments is still very much an ideal and not a practice. Those responses covered it pretty much. There are two things I would add again, coming back to the quality of jobs again and again. The people who need the training the most are those at the lower end of the labour market and at the lower end of the skill set, of course. And I think one thing that we need to be certain of is that when we undertake training, we do it in a way that actually gives workers a pathway into the labour market. Now, we can do that by, first of all, coordinating with local businesses and with business, entire business sectors. So I think that level of coordination is very important between the public and the private sector. But we also need to make sure that those workers are then employed on a stable basis. So not just that the government subsidizes retraining or something, and then, you know, the company takes on the worker for a limited period. The idea is that there's a future path that is tied to the training. So I've seen that both work and fail in other countries. And that's a very important step to bear in mind. The other thing I would urge is just a general coordination between different policy areas. So labour markets aren't, you know, this thing in a bubble on their own. They're tied to the structure of the economy. They're tied to regional structures, to regional inequalities, and so on. So, for example, if there is a policy, for example, to do with transportation and improving the industrial potential of some areas in the country, then that has to be coordinated with retraining of workers and with skills and with jobs and so on. So I think that those are sort of the two additional points that I would make on this question.
Great, thank you. So there's a few questions we have, which are, and I'm sort of, you know, in inverted commas, sort of essentially sort of about development in some senses. And so Rania Ramli has talked about the impact of, you know, if we have the vaccines are predominantly in sort of richer countries, and then if we're talking about reshoring, what are the wider implications of the pandemic for global inequality? And I know a number of you touched on that in your presentations, but I'd be really interested to sort of push you a little bit more there. Aftab Khan had a question which wasn't explicitly about development, but he talked about the distinction between, you know, what can the private sector do and what can NGOs do to address these issues of labour market inequality. And I think this is sort of an important way of sort of thinking about what the, you know, where the solutions might come from. And then Nadia Najab also asked a question which is, I think, sort of in Sri Lanka, I think it's wonderful that we can get people from all over the world at these events, but she talked about caring responsibilities and how we can balance caring responsibilities in the sort of aftermath of the pandemic. And this is very close to my heart because you can probably hear my kids in the background. I'll start off, if it's okay, with Kirsten, and we'll go the other way around if that's okay for the development question.
Well, the impact of the vaccine campaigns at the moment has, of course, been incredibly unequal, and it seems that most of them are going to richer countries. But for once in the history of the world, the richer world has suffered more from COVID-19 than many developing countries. So while this is extremely important to roll out the vaccines as soon as possible, but it probably makes sense to roll it out first to the most affected areas in the globe. And that's not just richer countries and developed countries. There are also many developing countries on that list. The implications, I think, in developing countries in this instance are very similar to what we are experiencing here, in that the new technologies are taking over and shaping the way people work. Especially in developing countries, it wasn't taken for granted that people could work from home for a day a week or something like that, as we did in the UK even before the crisis. So the likelihood of change is still very significant, but of course also in developing countries you have much less access to the internet and to technology that you need in order to make these changes, to roll out these changes over the whole of the population. So one of the key driving factors of inequality there is actually the inequality of access to technology as we go forwards. Now, reshoring, I've been thinking about this a lot. It creates opportunities potentially in the developed countries, generating jobs that are quite relatively high tech in manufacturing. I would hope that reshoring also means that the installed capacity in developing countries is used going forwards for those markets themselves, and hopefully that developing countries can develop their own capacities for production and still make use of that cheap labour that they have. In all cases, all of this and the impact of the COVID crisis and the existing inequalities and future inequalities of the labour market require very significant coordination with the private sector, and NGOs can be very helpful in facilitating this process. The kind of dialogue that in a developed country you take for granted between employers and workers, between unions and employers and government and so on, these links don't necessarily or very often just simply do not exist in developing countries, and they need to be strengthened, and NGOs and international institutions have a very, very strong role to play there, not just in terms of shaping and leveling the playing field, but also in terms of facilitating and strengthening the hand of workers. As Avik was saying earlier on, that's a very important way of facing this issue. With the caring responsibilities, I think there the situation is somewhat different in developing countries compared to developed ones. Certainly moving to the UK for me has been a bit of a shock to the system, because if anything, we're much more deprived here of childcare possibilities than we are in developing countries, where people have larger families, have more people around, people coordinate themselves in neighbourhoods, etc., to take care of childcare. So I think this is an issue that, especially in the developed world, is a big issue, or rather the policies for this in developed countries and developing ones are very, very different. I guess the key thing here is to, again, level the playing field. We expect women to take care of children. We can see that in the statistics with the COVID crisis. We can start by, creating as much paternity leave as maternity leave, that sort of thing, and really, address this also through regulation from that perspective.
Fantastic, thank you. Avik?
So I think I kind of touched on a whole bunch of points around global inequality. So I think that stands, as I said. As Kirsten just said, it's been a pleasant surprise, I guess. I guess it hasn't been, the global inequality hasn't got much worse, I think, in the past year. But there are a lot of reasons to be concerned. And as I said, particularly, I think the issue around debt, the capacity of governments in poorer countries to continue to support their citizens is going to be really important in the years to come. Because the immediate health shock might have passed, but the economic shock will persist and might be almost as contagious. In terms of the private sector, I guess the obvious thing is if you're a private firm, then be a good employer. You can see all the trends, you can see all the things that we're aiming for, and firms can support their workers in ways that that kind of promote all the things that we're looking for here. So invest in your workers, give them the opportunity to train and upskill where possible. Be flexible around remote working, be understanding and with your workers in terms of caring responsibilities, all of these things. It's kind of obvious, but I think it's important and it's worth saying. And firms probably have more power often than we give them credit for in policy discussions, because the question is absolutely right, but sometimes it's too focused on what governments do rather than other elements of society. On caring responsibilities, honestly, I have no idea. I'll be fascinated to see which way it goes. You can imagine certainly with flexible working, it might be easier to balance caring responsibilities with work, and in some ways it might kind of facilitate a better balance and people being able to kind of juggle work and life and family commitments a bit better. We might hope that out of this there might be a greater appreciation for care work, and that might kind of change, lead to a change in norms, but we'll see. I think is a short answer.
Wonderful. Yvette, can you, in particular, I'm interested in your views on sort of how we balance caring responsibilities, and also about, you know, beyond, because you mentioned unions, and the question is, you know, what can NGOs or unions or beyond the government do to sort of address these problems?
Yeah, so starting with the caring responsibilities, I mean, I think there has been a serious lack of a proper childcare strategy during the COVID crisis. I think childminders, nurseries have really struggled. They're a vital part of the economy, a real enabling part of the economy, and they have really struggled and been an afterthought in terms of the government's response. Some areas like the furlough scheme, government has done very well in its response, but other areas like support for sectors like these, I think it has been atrocious. And I think it is, in terms of where this goes from here, I think it's true that the remote working may make it easier for many parents to be able to manage the school run or things, because you're no longer having to combine things with a difficult commute. Although what we've also seen is while schools have been closed completely, this has been particularly a pressure on mothers. I've got constituency cases where I'm pursuing major employers who have been refusing to furlough women workers who are trying to support their kids at home and trying to manage, even though it's possible to furlough under those circumstances, and have been forcing these women to take unpaid leave instead. And so pushing people out of the labour market, and I'm worried about the kind of long-term inequalities that may be causing as well. So I think the issue, it's true, this crisis ought to be telling us to value care work much more strongly, but I think that's going to require leadership. And it's going to require leadership from government, from other institutions, in order to make that something positive that comes out of this crisis, as opposed to something that is temporarily talked about, but then actually just disappears by the wayside. And in fact, you simply see the inequalities grow, and for a lot of women in the labour market feeling that actually the clock has been turned back, a lot of dads struggling in the labour market feeling that things have been made harder for them instead. So this is a bit of a fork in the road moment on this. We could do something very positive coming out of this, but at the moment, based on the lack of any kind of proper childcare strategy over the last 12 months, I am very worried that the government will fail to do that. In terms of what the roles are for other institutions, the different for NGOs, for private sector, for employers to do, there's huge potential on this. We ought to have, I think, a much better social partnership system with organisations and institutions working more effectively together in order to manage the impact of technological change so that we can take the advantages of it and have everybody benefit from it, rather than it just end up being a free for all where those who have the fewest qualifications or those who start with least end up also being hit worst as well. And I think for the private sector, for private employers, there's huge potential for them to do more. Obviously, there's the issues about just being a good employer, as Avik said, dealing with some of the pay inequalities and injustices and insecurities within their own workforce. But there's more as well. So, for example, making sure that there is proper training and education for the workforce, including the lowest paid in the workforce and the least skilled. Because at the moment, the more skills you have, the more likely you are to be getting more training from your employer. The fewer skills you have, the less likely you are to be getting any training support from your employer. Or doing things like moving staff around. One of the employees we went to see during the commission talked about how building resilience of the workforce so that people aren't simply in the same repetitive job all the time and are moved around in different occupations within the workforce hugely increases people's resilience, so that when new technology changes within the workplace and then people need to be able to adapt, they're much more easily able to do so than if in fact they've been left to just do the same job with the same, you know, range of skills over a long period of time. So all those kinds of things that can boost the resilience and the skills and education of the workforce, and then work with with people, with staff, with trade unions, with their representatives, and consult properly on new technology being introduced, on what the opportunities are. If you do that consultation, you're far more likely to get technology that works and improves productivity, and also have the positive environment in the workplace that means that everybody benefits from new technology as well.
Neil, could I just add a point to this discussion? Both the debate about skills and also what Yvette just said about childcare and how companies deal with these issues, these are all things that theoretically we can hold companies accountable for. And if you look at the various different annual reports in Europe from different companies that are based in different countries, you will see that they publish different kinds of information about their employee relationships, personnel management, facilities, and so on. And it really ranges from rather quite substantial information to nothing at all once you move to the US, or very little. And so this is something that can easily be put on the agenda. We require companies to produce a whole host of financial data, but ask for very little else.
Quite. I mean, so Alex Gibbs has an important question here about the importance and power of large firms and how we can hold government to account. And I think you've just answered it very well. I just wanted to finish off, so we don't have too long, so I wanted to finish off with a quick round on policy, actually. And so there's a couple of questions, and I will just ask you to sort of speak to whatever you think is most important here. So Naomi Clayton talks about the sort of long-term sort of long-term falling investment in training and what we can do to sort of make this a moment where things get better, to sort of, you know, tackle this moment rather than just letting training continue to decline. Johnny Ross Tatum talks about sort of social security. He's another student of mine, so you've got to be nice. He suggests, you know, has this shown up the social security system and the sort of problems, and how would we address that? There's a couple of questions on sort of the north-south divide and geographical issues about rural versus urban context, also very important. And Thomas Colwell has talked about job quality as well. So, you know, what can we do in terms of job quality? So I'll just a few reflections each on that, because we don't have too long. So who wants to go first? Kirsten, do you want to kick off? Maybe take the job quality point in particular.
Start with a sort of big picture ethical thing. What I said is we treat workers very, very differently. I think one of the key things that we need to do, not just in terms of regulation, but also in terms of how much a job costs an employer, is to level the playing field. So it costs you an awful lot less to employ a worker as an independent contractor than it costs you to employ them as a full-time employee. We all know that. But short-term contracts, for example, are not covered by employment protection legislation and are therefore potentially cheaper to employers than long-term jobs. So these are things where we need to start internalizing the cost of these precarious forms of work in what we demand from employers. So for example, okay, no employment protection legislation, how about an additional contribution because after this short-term job, the likelihood of being unemployed for X number of months is Y. That sort of thing. So in the UK, at least, we can be relatively sure that people who are on short term or 0 hours or temporary contracts do contribute when they are working. The key issue is to calculate, well, you know, how much are they contributing out of the year, or, you know, compared to a full time job, etc. So these precarious forms of contracts, they shouldn't just be used as a way of increasing the flexibilization of the labour market. There should be a cost associated to this flexibility that should go to the worker, and that should compensate for the insecurity that they generate through this massive risk shift that shifts risk from companies to employees. And so I think that's where government and regulation and working together with companies, holding entire economic sectors accountable for how they employ people, that's an incredibly important step in this process. So level the playing field in every shape or form, and publish the data, publish, you know, measure job quality as a government, force companies to publish what they're doing. I think that can go quite a long way towards leveling the playing field as well.
Wonderful. Measurement, yeah, I often think matters. Avik?
In the training and skills agenda, like, there's lots of technical details we can go into, but I think it's in some senses it's really simple. Just, we need more public investment, and everything else is secondary. Colleges, a huge number of colleges are running deficits. The adult education budget has been decimated. Just if you put money in first, and then we can figure out everything else later, I would say. I'm interested in the social security question. I'm not sure how it has shown up, social security. I say it's almost the opposite, in that it's shown that when the government puts its mind to social security, it can do quite a lot quite quickly and do some interesting things. And if anything, it's shown kind of the neglect of social security prior to the crisis. But there are some interesting kind of long-term decisions to be made. And sorry, this is throwing a bit of a grenade in last minute, but Kirsten's point about kind of attachment about the corporatist model or the liberal model, I think links to a broad question about what sort of a social security system we have. To what extent do we want to be linking benefits to employers and the sort of employment, the sort of job you have, as the furlough scheme did, where it replaced your income, and the better, the higher income you had, the more you got, versus something that has much more flexibility.
Avik, I'm going to have to stop you there because we're running out of time, but thank you very much. Yvette, to finish things off.
I guess final few quick thoughts. I think the social security system has to support education and training. It's crazy that you can't properly learn and train while you are on universal credit and looking for work, unable to work. So we should be making sure that you can do that, or that you can look for part-time work alongside doing part-time training and education and getting yourself the skills for the future as well, that you should be able to get statutory training pay and statutory training leave. And that should be built into a modern future welfare system, supporting the skills that we need for the future, as well as tackling the kind of inequalities and injustices that we see. And then I thought on the geographic divide, I mean, it's really interesting, the Future Fund, which was a scheme set up by the government during the COVID crisis to support innovative companies facing financial difficulties. It's helped about 1,000 firms. So these are, we presume, that the firms that are going to be the sort of new, you know, tech supporting jobs of the future. Of those 1,000 firms, 730 of them are in London. And then only 29 are in the Northeast, and only 31 are in Yorkshire. So the government support programmes are ending up still widening that north-south economic divide. We're not using the investment to support the economic growth and the jobs growth that tackles that inequality and divide as well. And we also need to make sure we're dealing with the divides between cities and towns. There may be opportunities to address that in the way that Yvette talked about, in terms of the remote working, changing the way in which people can work far more in towns. You can reboost town economies, but again, it needs active engagement, it needs active policy, it needs proper devolution to give those towns the ability to do that and to invest in that, and it needs backing by government to do that. And again, I don't see that level of plan, strategy and approach to the future, how we come out of the crisis, how we build back better. The government has set up a Build Back Better Council. I think it's got about 30 people on it. I think there's only one or two people who are actually from the north. 22 of them are from London. So once again, we're not actually getting a strategy to build back better that is about the whole of the country and about tackling those inequalities and injustices. We can do this. What the COVID crisis has taught us is actually we can do impossible things when we have to, when we're forced to. We've done amazing things. We've tried to turn them around. But actually, on that note, as our caring responsibilities are kind of put in front of us on the screen, on that note, I think we have the opportunity, but we've got to seize it.
Sorry about that. And thank you very much. Thank you very much for those comments. Look, it's been a really fascinating discussion. I think we could have gone on for quite a lot longer. Apologies if we haven't answered your questions. But thank you very much to everyone who attended. Thank you very much to Nina, Lisa, the interpreters, the sign language people. Thank you very much for that. But most of all, thank you very much for our speakers. Well, it was wonderful. Thank you very much. We can't clap you physically, so it'll just have to be me. But thank you very much. Hugely appreciated.
Thank you
very much. That was a great event. Thank you, Neil, for organising it and for inviting us.
Thank you.